The villain. Leo had won. He'd faced crushing defeats. He'd suffered terrible losses. But he'd won a victory bigger than anyone could have believed. He sat at the head of the closed council, the most powerful man in the Union, in the circle of the world, maybe. Who'd dare deny it? The Burners had used the White Chamber as a stable, a little fuck-yourself from judge to the old regime, which had left the place smelling faintly of horse, however thoroughly it was scrubbed. The table and chairs were the same ones King Giselle's closed council had used, as battered and scarred as Leo was, but he'd ordered them left in their places. A timely reminder to anyone he let sit in here that they could always be replaced. The chosen few filed in respectfully. First came Leo's old friends, Lord Chamberlain Durand and Lord Marshal Glarwood. They sat down grinning on his left and right, and Leo grinned to see them there. It reminded him for a moment of those high old times, until he remembered everything he'd sacrificed to win, everyone he'd sacrificed. He wished Antaup and Jin and Barnaver and Ritter were there too. But wishing does no good. Lord Admiral Huygen and Lord Chancellor Isher were the next to enter, sporting more gold thread between them than a set of palace curtains, uniforms as splendid as their military records were wretched. The best men on the open council, or at any rate, the best runners. Two bureaucrats followed. Victorine Danteuffel's sudden disappearance, to the bottom of the canal, he hoped, had left the Archlector's chair open for Lawson, superior of Westport, who seemed a man untroubled by conscience. High Consul Flassenbeck was one of the few officials of the old government lucky and cunning enough to tiptoe alive through the purges. They were hardly the sort of men that Leo admired, but he supposed someone had to take care of the details, and luck, cunning, and lack of conscience were certainly qualities his new union would need. Finally came the four freshly minted ministers, people who understood the modern world, supposedly. Durand had pleaded with Leo to give Savine that much, and pointed out the magic she'd worked on the government of Angland, and in the end he'd grudgingly admitted it made sense. Inventors and industrialists in shiny civilian clothing, and at the back, having toned down the bosom somewhat, but still smelling strongly of roses, none other than Celeste Danteuffel. A woman in the White Chamber would have caused uproar a few years ago, but progress and all that. Leo saw no harm in having something ornamental to look at, as long as she remembered her place. He winced as they grovelled their greetings and slipped into their seats. He'd won, there was no denying it, but the stump of his leg hurt no less, his metal-riddled arm felt no more. There was that same bitter tang in the gap in his teeth. His temper, if anything, was shorter than ever. He'd won, but it was nothing like his victory over Stour Nightfall in the Circle. No adoration from the crowds, only fear and suspicion. No surge of joy, only a nagging dissatisfaction. No hugs from his friends. He'd led most of them to their deaths. He was surprised when he heard the door shut, and the Lady Regent glided in. She could barely stand to look at him these days, let alone spend time in the same room. The way things were, he'd have been shocked if they ever fucked again. But he didn't miss it. Since he lost his leg, it had gone from what felt like work to what felt like humiliation. She could keep her quim to herself, and he'd take everything else and consider it a fair division of the assets.
"Joining us, Your Highness?" he asked.
"Since there is a seat free."
She calmly met his eye as she arranged herself with even more than usually regal bearing in the tall chair at the foot of the table, the one that for centuries had sat empty for the first of the Magi.
"Not expecting Baiaz, are we?"
Those might have been the first words they'd exchanged since the hanging, the slightest thaw in the winter of their marriage, or more likely,
Her ruthless, realistic self was worming its way back to the surface, and she was making the best of what she couldn't change. She'd always been a woman who liked to win, but if she intended to fight him now, she'd better get used to the taste of dirt. "I think we're all here." Leo sat forwards, setting his clenched fist on the table. "We have a new closed council. Young, hungry, a dozen men and women ready to reforge the Union for a new age." There was polite applause from everyone except Savine. She sat with that icy dignity she specialized in, glaring down the long table at Leo as though she could taste piss. But he wasn't about to let her wounded fucking feelings spoil his moment. "It grieves me to say that the nation is weak," he growled, grinding his fist into the wood. "The rot was already setting in long before the great change. The army is in demoralized tatters. We have to give the men back their pride, their purpose." Glarwood clapped his hands. "Well said, Your Highness. We could start by returning the Square of Marshals to its former glory. Those names underfoot are an ugly reminder of things better forgotten. The ruined flagstones must be replaced so we can have drills, parades, maneuvers, demonstrations of the Union's strength."
"I feel that would be a mistake," said Savine.
Leo licked sourly at the hole in his teeth. "You shock me."
"It should remain the Square of Martyrs," she said, holding his eye in a challenge he did not at all appreciate. "If we sponge away the evidence of our failures, how are we ever to learn from them? We should leave the names of those who died for the great change and add the names of those who died in it. Let us commemorate the horrors of the old regime and the new, in the hope that we shall never repeat them. We must have a better union."
Her knuckles were white as she clenched her own fist on the tabletop.
"It cannot all be for nothing. It cannot."
There was a thoughtful silence, then Kernsbeck slowly nodded.
"Very well said, Your Highness."
Leo frowned sideways at Durand. He was looking back earnestly, his brow lightly wrinkled, like a puppy begging for a treat. The look he always used to have when Leo's mother voiced some guff that he agreed with.
"Well,"
Leo worked his mouth, then with an effort forced his lips into the thinnest of smiles.
"Far be it from me to deny the darling of the slums a sentimental gesture or two. Call the place whatever you like. The larger point remains. We face threats on every border. Our fortresses are neglected and our navy outdated. The first order of business must be the reinforcement and renewal of the King's military."
"The Lord Regent makes an excellent point," interrupted Savine, "which is why our first order of business must be money. King Jizal's administration made many blunders, but their worst was spending what they did not have."
Everyone turned to look at Leo.
"We all know that," he grunted.
He needed no lecture on not making the same mistake twice.
"As a solid financial foundation, we need a new system of taxation," said Savine. "Minister for Revenue Valamir?"
"Sweeping reform, root and branch."
Valamir began to hand out neatly bound sheaves of printed paper. Down at that end of the table, it seemed they'd come armed.
"You will see various proposals here: increased levies on land and wealth, abolition of privileged categories and venal offices, tariffs on mercantile and industrial activity, strong measures against corruption."
"We cannot look back,"
said Kernsbeck, peering over his eye lenses.
"We must avoid the ruinous debts which poisoned King Jizal's reign."
"The great change freed us from the tyranny of the banks, at least," observed Court.
Isha leafed through the papers with an ever deeper frown.
"Only to chain us all under the yoke of the tax collector."
They began to argue, and tediously. Proportions, allowances, exemptions. Leo scarcely understood the issues. It almost made him wish he'd paid closer attention to his mother during those boring meetings of his council back in Angland. But not quite. He sank into his chair, wishing he'd brought wine. He belonged in the saddle, or perhaps some kind of open carriage would be less painful. He belonged near other men in the saddle, anyway. His eyes drifted sideways to Durand. On campaign, with the wind behind them and an enemy in front, calling for the charge with a sword in his hand.
"We need money to rebuild," Court was saying.
"To modernize," said Kernsbeck.
"To mount a summer fencing contest this year," offered Celeste. "A beloved tradition to give the people inspiration, reassurance, and common purpose."
"An excellent idea,"
and Savine tapped the table approvingly with her fingertips. Leo smashed it with his fist, jerking the faces back towards him where they belonged.
"We need money for our forces, cannons, ships. What use is progress if it can't be made into a weapon? Union arms must be respected again. We have to strangle our enemies at sea and crush them on land. We need to be feared."
Smashing the table had worked once, so he did it again, even harder, making a heap of papers slump over in front of Court.
"We should press a claim on the city of Sapani."
There was a nervous silence. The High Consul cleared his throat.
"On what basis, Your Highness?"
"You'll think of something."
Loaded glances crossed the table.
"But Sapani has long been considered neutral."
"The Snake of Tarlins once captured the city," grumbled Lawson. "But even she did not presume to keep it. We would provoke a furious response from the Styrians."
"I'm bloody counting on it," said Leo.
Glaward and Huygen nodded along, but even Durand didn't look convinced. He'd gone from the bloody begging look to the bloody pained look. Next he'd be quoting Stolichus on the virtues of patience. Savine looked evenly at him down the table.
"King Jazal fought 3 wars against the Styrians. All he achieved was to waste millions, kill thousands, and pour the Union's prestige down the sewer. We must modernize our military, undoubtedly. We must protect our interests, of course. But we have far more to gain through trade with Styria than war. I suggest we invite King Jappo on a state visit to Adua to discuss areas of mutual interest."
"What mutual interest could we have with that fucking degenerate?" sneered Leo.
"Styria is a growing market," observed
Court, jowls wobbling.
"Tremendous opportunities," burbled Kernsbeck.
"It could be a pragmatic solution,"
grated Archlector Lawson. Savine shrugged.
"Sometimes there are better ways to get what you want than through force."
Perhaps there were, but Leo wasn't interested in them, and he certainly wasn't interested in wasting more breath on the subject.
"Let's put it to the vote," he snapped. "Those in favour of laying claim to Sapani?"
He threw up a careless hand, and arms shot up along with it. Durand's, Glaward's, Lord Huygen's. But that was all. Further down the table, no one moved. Leo stared at them, unable to believe it. It was like Stauffenbeck all over again, looking out as the sun came up, sure of victory, and finding, to his cold dismay, the enemy had been reinforced. As if to rub it in, Savine let the silence stretch a few more awkward moments before she calmly spoke.
"Those in favour of a state visit?"
Hands went up more slowly, but no less decisively, and there were a lot more of them. It was no surprise that Savine's 4 stooges might want to vote her way, but it was a shock they had the guts to do it. It was an even bigger one that Flassenbeck and Lawson might dare to defy him. But Leo supposed you should never trust bureaucrats, especially those who've survived purges. It was the final betrayal that truly beggared belief, though.
Lord Chancellor Isher, in the seat Leo had just given him, politely raised his braid-heavy arm.
"What do you think you're doing?"
whispered Leo. Isher cleared his throat.
"Agreeing with Her Highness the Lady Regent,"
he droned, careful not to meet Leo's eye.
"We have far more to gain through trade with Styria than war."
Meaning he had more to gain. Leo wanted to call him a backstabbing coward to his face, then demand to know what Savine had bribed him with, but he was so flabbergasted he couldn't find the breath. He looked across at Durand, and Durand stared back, pale with shock. Evidently, this was one outflanking that a careful study of Stolichus hadn't prepared him for.
8-4 in favour of a state visit, said Savine, making a neat little note. High Consul Flassenbeg, would you summon the Styrian ambassador so we can advance a formal invitation to King Jappo? Then, Lady Celeste, could you liaise with my private secretary Zuri on an agenda for the talks?
What the fuck?
Snarled Leo, spraying spit. Another silence, even more awkward than the last. Savine went on writing for a moment, then looked up from her papers.
Perhaps the closed council might give His Highness and I a moment to confer?
By the speed they scrambled from their seats, they were desperate to do exactly that. With one nervous backward glance, Celeste Danhuygen pulled the door to the White Chamber shut, leaving Savine alone with her husband. She could not help shifting in that uncomfortable bloody chair at a sudden pang. With impeccable timing, her menses had come for the first time since she fell pregnant, and just as painfully as ever. The familiar dull ache through her belly and down the backs of her thighs, with an occasional sharp twinge into her arse by way of light relief. As she always used to, she struggled with every muscle to look perfectly relaxed, and forced her grimace into an expression of quiet dignity.
"Do you think I'll let you steal this from me?"
whispered Leo, white with fury. Savine had no doubt that he had become a very dangerous man. She remembered seeing him stab Lord Marshal Forrest in the chest without a hint of hesitation. But she had faced dangerous men before. Preparation was the key. That, and never backing down.
"Steal this? The Union, you mean?"
Savine spoke slowly, precisely, like a schoolteacher explaining arithmetic to a pupil prone to tantrums. Perhaps that would only enrage him further. She rather hoped so.
"It is not yours, Leo. It belongs to our son, the king. We are merely the caretakers, the joint caretakers."
He clawed at the table, catching some papers and crushing them in his trembling fist. He might only have the one that worked, but she knew how strong it still was.
"Get out!"
he snarled through gritted teeth. Savine set her jaw.
"Let me be blunt. You will beat me in a foot race before you remove me from this chamber."
"I am in command here."
"Are you sure? I begin to think you did not read the Open Council's Grand Declaration very carefully." "I wrote it carefully, I promise you that. It gives me exactly the same rights, privileges, and powers as you. Matters of policy are decided by votes in this council, and, as you see, the strong majority are on my side."
"Then I'll remove them."
"Until His Majesty reaches his majority, you cannot remove them without my approval, as I could not appoint them without yours."
"Then I'll march a company of soldiers in here."
He had become even paler. The skull-like rings around his eyes reminded her more than was comfortable of her father. But while her father had done awful things, he had stopped short of having heroic paintings made of them.
"We'll see which way these bastards vote with drawn swords at their necks."
Savine narrowed her eyes.
"You will beat me at left-handed darts before you do that. You should know that I have made comprehensive arrangements. Try to seize power and the coal will stop coming,
and the bread will stop coming, and the money will stop coming. I'll chain you up in strikes and riots. I'll bury you in a blizzard of pamphlets. Have you seen how popular I am these days? Threaten the mother of the nation? Depose the darling of the slums? You'd have another great change on your hands, supposing the army fought for you. But bear in mind, their oath isn't to you, it's to the king. And you are not king, Leo. You're less king than I am.
There was a brooding silence as they glared at one another down the length of that battered table in the dingy, stuffy, faintly horse-smelling room that was the very pinnacle of power.
So, you stabbed me in the fucking back?
His voice had a wounded whine to it.
My own wife! I should have left you to the burners.
It was his bad luck that this reinvention of the past coincided with a particularly savage cramp, as if there was a fist clenching around her guts. She jerked forwards, showing him her teeth.
You fucking did, you treacherous shit. And then you seized the throne against my wishes. And then you killed my brother. And now I'll make you pay the fucking bill.
As she snarled the words, his expression changed from fury to amazement and ended in a joyless bark of laughter.
Oh, so I'm the villain. Funny what we forget, isn't it? Remember our rebellion? I want to change the closed council, but leave Orso on the throne. That's what you told me you wanted. And the darling of the slums wouldn't lie to her own husband, would she?
Savine swallowed and said nothing. Leo stabbed with a finger at Isha's empty chair.
Because the flexible Lord Isha told me a different story, that you agreed with him also would be quietly shuffled off so you could be queen. And that wasn't the only deal you made behind my back, was it? I thought it was strange how Stour just,
and he snapped his fingers,
changed his mind about helping us. No wonder, since you offered him Ufrith.
Savine had to stop herself grimacing, but her husband had not finished listing her crimes.
When we hanged your precious brother, I didn't hear you begging for his life. You knew it had to be done. You knew, but you wanted someone to blame. Do you believe your own lies or just pretend to? The hypocrisy!
And he clutched at the tabletop, wrenched at it as though he'd rip it off.
How can you sit there with a straight face, talking of the horrors of the old regime? You were the old regime. It was your own father who carved those names into the square of martyrs. No one profited more than you, and no one cared less. Now you dare to put on a white dress and preach to me that it can't all be for nothing? Play the Saint of Adua out there if you please, Savine,
he snared at her.
But in here, let's not embarrass ourselves. You can call me treacherous, call me ruthless, but ask who I learned it from.
Another brooding silence as they glowered at each other from the hard chairs to which their ambitions had swept them. Then, for once, Savine let her shoulders drop.
You're right, she said, wincing as she tried to press at her aching belly through her corset.
He was right, after all.
Maybe I came to regret the things I had done, and so I hated to see you do the same. The truth is, I played my part in it all, the lead role even. I schemed and lied and betrayed, and you are the one who has paid the price. You. And also, and all those I ground to dust in my mills and turned to meat on my battlefields and let rot in my slums. I am sorry for that. Sorry for Orso and sorry for you. Sorry for all of it. But thinking now, if I had the same choices to make, I cannot say I would not do it all again. She met his eyes and gave a little shrug. Maybe, after all, I'm the villain. Leo glared at her from the other end of the table.
So, you're back down about Sapani?
Oh, no.
I won't back down about anything.
He stared a moment longer, mouth slightly open. Then he sagged in his chair.
Is this how it always is? You get what you wanted, but somehow it's not what you wanted at all. Every victory turns out to be just another kind of defeat.
He looked so withered, so ruined, she was caught between disgust and pity. She could not forgive him, but she knew she had helped make him what he was. For better or worse, they were shackled together. She put aside her anger and gave a weary sigh.
This is not a victory or a defeat, Leo. It is a marriage.
Now she slipped the box from her sleeve and took a pinch up one nostril.
I suggested to you before our wedding that you should look on it as a business relationship.
She smothered a sneeze.
I suggest you continue to do so. Partners need not see eye to eye on every point. They can even, frankly, detest each other on a personal level.
She took a pinch up the other nostril.
But sensible ones collaborate for the good of the business. I suggest we collaborate for the good of our children. They need their father. For the good of the union, it needs its champion.
She dabbed her nose clean.
We have the chance to do so much good together. It would be a crime to throw it away simply because we cannot agree.
And she closed the box with a snap.
I'll fight you, if I must.
Leo shifted his useless left arm in his jacket.
I've never backed down from a fight.
Please. Savine suppressed a wince at another twinge in her belly.
This is no storybook. You might not be the villain, but you're for damn sure not the hero.
She forced her shoulders back and her smile back on.
Celeste!
The door opened a crack to show the well-powdered face of the new Minister for Commerce.
Your Highness?
Bring the closed council back in.
We have work to do.